The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sky Broadband. Unlimited broadband so you can download, upload and stream as much as you like.
Hello and welcome to our weekly podcast. This is a compilation of all our best interviews from the last 5 days, all in the one place. And so, this week, cocooning is a new requirement for older people to stay at home during the COVID-19 crisis. Former rally driver Rosary Smith told me how it has been working out for her. Country music star Mike Denver spoke to me about becoming a new dad at a time when hospital guidelines prevented him from attending the birth of his daughter Mia. Set and costume designer Molly O'Cahan told me how she's been passing the time indoors by dressing her parents up as famous works of art. And Brian Penny talked to me about overcoming heroin addiction and getting a second chance at life. Plus, Olympic swimmer Nicholas Quinn spoke to me about the postponement of the Tokyo Olympics and how swimming helped him deal with the tragic death of his father. So that's it. Thanks for listening, and I hope you all enjoy it. Now let's say good morning to Rosemary Smith.
Good morning, Oliver.
Former rally driver, Rosemary.
Yes.
From the golden era of Monte Carlo and all of that.
Really and all of that.
Cool.
Oh, yeah, but I still do some. This is the thing. People think, you know, just the older you get, you can't do these things. But we still do a lot of the classic rallies here and in England and in France and have a ball. It's great.
Brilliant. Now, cocooning is a word you're getting very familiar with. This is the requirement for older people who've been advised to stay in and anyone who's medically vulnerable, to use the HSE terminology. And that must be really difficult. How are you finding it?
I don't mind it at all, Oliver, funny enough. No, I don't. I've plenty to do. I do miss going out to work, though. I really do, because I run a driving school, and of course that's closed down totally.
Yes.
And but besides that, I've got wonderful neighbours. My next door neighbour, Deborah, she is absolutely wonderful. She looks after me like a clucking mother hen in the nicest possible way. I know she can collect stuff for me and put the papers through my door and that sort of thing. No, I really don't mind it very much because, you know, sort of my father was exactly the same. He was very happy in his own company. He'd read. When he died, actually, he was learning Russian. So,
right.
I mean, I'm learning Russian, I assure you. I practically can't even read my own name or write my own name. But that's by the by. No, I have a very good friend and they come and they put stuff on the doorstep and flowers and wine, of course, as you might have seen in the paper the other day. But I assure people that we don't sit drinking wine all night out in our front gardens. No, we don't. We only do that once or twice. But the weather, though it's been bright, it's been very chilly.
Yes.
And, you know, you just can't. You get cold before you get anything else.
It doesn't take long before you run back in again.
Well, that's true. But, I mean, anybody can do it in their gardens with cups of tea or whatever they particularly want. But it just means at a distance of 2 feet or 2 metres, I should say, that you can sort of keep up with the world, if you like.
Yeah.
But I must say, I mean, the television coverage of this has been phenomenal. Thank heavens it's at last getting through to people that this is a really serious epidemic. Because for the first few weeks, you know, people were sort of saying, yeah, and they were still going around in groups and they were still meeting their friends and walking around Dublin. But, I mean, the streets, as I was hearing on the radio this morning, they're absolutely empty.
Yeah.
And I think it's wonderful. And I have a great supermarket, Super Value, and they drop stuff up to me as well when I ring them up.
Yeah.
Because I'm in the high risk category because I've got six heart stents. And I'm old. Remember that. I'm 82.
You don't sound a bit of it.
No, I don't feel a bit of it, Oliver.
Great.
This is the whole wonderful thing about it. And I miss going out because I am very sociable and I've a lot of very good friends. But, you know, I do miss in a bit. But, you know, I was told 2 weeks before the lockdown last Friday night that I was to stay in. I was to as much as possible cocoon. I could go for walks, just short walks down the road and back up again. But I can't even do that now. They tell me I must stay in the house or in my back garden.
And when you need stuff, people bring that stuff to you and don't even interact with them. That is the cocooning.
No, which is awful. You know, I sort of stand in my front window and they're down on the drive and we're sort of yelling at each other out through the window. But it's just, you see, people who haven't got this sort of, outlook. I mean, a lot of people, they really are cocooned. They might only live in an apartment. They mightn't see anybody. Nobody comes to them. But I live in a lovely area and I've got, you know, lots of people. Though I see very few people walking up and down or even driving up and down now. But I do have lots of seagulls. I have a lovely green out in front of me here. And I've had loads of seagulls. Somebody's talking about the seagulls. There are loads of seagulls
out. But you're really positive and you're quite happy to do this cocooning thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It probably helps that it's actually quite a nice word, isn't it? Cocooning.
Listen, I think this is gorgeous. A lovely friend of mine over in Galway sent me a lovely message saying, yesterday when you come out of the cocoon, you'll come out as a beautiful butterfly.
Very nice thought.
It
will save people's lives. That is the key thing.
Absolutely, absolutely. But at least, you know, Boris Johnson, who wouldn't close down England as such, at least he got a dose of it. Now it's all closed down. But when is Donald Trump going to get into his thick head that, you know, he was going on the other day about saying that he was going to have the churches open on Easter Sunday and he was going to have full houses.
He's going to have everything open. And he's just saying, it's not going to listen, they're going to defeat the virus. Trust me.
That man is.
Trust me, believe me. Tell us what you really think, Rosemary. But you are a bit of a news junkie then.
Oh, I love to know what's going on around the world. I mean, regardless of this terrible epidemic we're having now. But I'd always watch the news. I'd read the newspapers from cover to cover. I like to know. I like to be educated in what's going on.
Yeah. And are you dreaming at the moment of getting back into a rally car and racing around the place?
Well, we had a number of events lined up for this year. Of course, this weekend actually just gone by now, we were to be down in Wexford. And then in a few weeks' time, there's a thing called the Gordon Bennett. And I suppose that'll be off. And then, you know, there are so many things because nobody has any idea how long this virus is going to and how many people it's going to reach. So obviously the best thing to do is just stay away from other people. Oh,
stay
I'm looking out now
home.
And I see two people out in the green in front of me and they have a lovely dog. You see, if you have a dog, you must bring it out. So it's nice to see there's some life around here.
2 kilometres. 2 kilometres of which.
No, but I can't even do that, Oliver. That's my difficulty. I can't do that.
But you sound very positive and very happy to do that. So that's the main thing.
I am.
Tell us a little bit about the days in Monte Carlo when you were a competitive rally driver.
Yeah.
I mean, what era are we talking here?
Oh, we're talking 60s, 70s, up into the 80s. But it was just, it was phenomenal. But you see, the thing is, I won a lot of stuff around that era, but there was no social media. There was no thing. And if, you know, I sort of, say I got third overall in an event, and then, you know, there's the ladies' award. So they say, oh, you can only have one award, so you'll have the ladies' award. No, I wanted the third overall award.
Yes.
I didn't want the ladies' award, because you could be last and get the ladies' award. So
the car was a car.
The car, you know, there were different sorts of cars. This is the whole point. And if you had a slower car, you weren't going to win. I remember years ago, Gordon Richards saying to me, Rosemary, if I'd been put on a cart horse, I would never have won a race. That's what I said about some of the cars I drove. But anyway, there were exciting times and I met Grace Kelly. And, you know, it was just, but everybody, you know, and Monte Carlo in January is just phenomenal with the mimosa trees out and the sun glittering on the sea. And it has that magical air. And, we always strove to get there because we'd have a lovely about 5 days there and going to the casino and going to the ball at the end of it. And, and as I say, meeting Rainier and Princess Grace and all this sort of carry on. So, they were wonderful days.
And you'll be back out in the car when this is all over again.
When this is all over, I certainly will. But I mean, at the moment, my lovely little car is sitting in the driveway. And, you know, that's where it's staying at the moment. So, yeah. No, I'm quite happy, actually. I really am. But I do appreciate people who they're not happy with their own company. You know, they're sort of, you know, they can't sit still and do nothing. But I don't mind it at all. I'm propped up here in bed now talking to you. And I think it's lovely. Now, I wander down and have my breakfast, very late breakfast. Yeah. But
and I think you were photographed at the weekend enjoying a glass of wine. So that'll carry on.
Yeah. When the weather isn't so cold, it will carry on. But, you know, I mean, as I say, you don't have to be sitting at the wall drinking wine. You can sit at the wall and drink tea or coffee and eat chocolate biscuits till they come out your ears.
You can drink wine responsibly and sensibly. Listen, you're a great advocate for cocooning, Rosemary.
As I say, I'm lucky. I am lucky.
And you have an autobiography, Driven. So it was just simply called Driven?
Yes, it was. Yeah,
so people can look that up online, order it in, and they won't be looking at the walls.
They won't, and it's quite a fun book, actually, because it's not all about driving. When the name Driven came out, it was about my attitude to life. If something knocks you down, you say, hump it. You get up and you carry on again. Okay. And this is how I look at life.
Absolutely brilliant. Thank you very much, Rosemary.
Thank you, Oliver. It's lovely talking to you.
Good luck to you. Good morning. Stay home, stay safe. That's the message. On the line is Mike Denver. Good morning to you, Mike.
Morning to you, Oliver. How are you?
Country music impresario, star of the ages.
That's some introduction. How are you?
I'm grand. You're over at home in Portumna in County Galway, which is like Galway's home of hurling, isn't it?
Well, it's definitely the home of hurling in County Galway. So it is, yeah. It's a great town for sports, and I suppose that's on a standstill now as well.
And country music, but you're obviously on a pause, and it probably couldn't have happened at a better time.
Yeah, we're on a pause now. It seems to be a longer pause than we were expecting, but yeah, it's a great time for me. I suppose something that really suits what I'm at for another couple of weeks.
Yeah.
If it lasted another week or two, and then I'd be a very happy man to get back on the road and start working again.
So congratulations, you're a dad for the first time.
Yeah, thank you very much.
How are mother and baby?
Mother and baby are great. Yeah, Liz and baby me are great here. They're just upstairs now at the moment, just after getting fed. So they're doing a bit of wind in there at the moment and relaxing, right. And the feet are up. So it's a great time for me. It's a very exciting time, first baby, so we're really having a great time.
Now, Liz didn't have an easy time of it when she was pregnant, had she?
Yeah, we did, it was a long road, I suppose, for the last couple of months, I suppose, really since October. Really, it's been a long road where she's been nearly bedbound for the last few months between being bed rest, I suppose, and between hospitals. It's been a long road, but it's definitely worth it. So it is when you see the end result. There's nothing really like it.
And she's doing well now, as you say.
Yeah, everybody's great. So she is. They're all flying. The baby is mighty. She's getting stronger and stronger. She was a few weeks early, but she's back on track now. So she is, and she's feeding well, and she's keeping us all happy and all on our toes.
So she did. She arrived a couple of weeks earlier then, but you were kind of expecting
Yeah, we were half. We were expecting it. There was a great team down in Galway. We had a great consultant down there, Una Conway, which we'd been dealing with for the last long time, really. And she looked after us very well, so she did, and all her team down there. I suppose it was just difficult times in the last couple of weeks, or in the last month, really. I suppose with all the troubles and all different things, so it made it a little more difficult than normal.
And how did you get to go into the hospital, or what were the rules like?
Yeah,
it was
very strict, Oliver. So it was. I suppose it was different because Liz was in and out of hospital, as I said, for the last couple of months. She was nearly the last month before she had the baby in the hospital. So I was in and out every day. It was nearly free flow as I wanted in and out into the hospital until the last week. Just before that, they got a little more strict and partners weren't allowed in, so it was a little more difficult time.
And on the day itself, when little Mia decided to arrive into the world,
yes,
tell us about what happened.
Yeah, she was born on the 20th of the 3rd of 20, so it's an easy date for me to remember. Yeah. So it is on the Friday morning, 12:51 a.m. she was born, and she was small. She was a little on the small size, but she's as I said, she's thriving. She was only four pounds 13.
Wow.
So she was nice and small, but it was a difficult time. It's a difficult time. I know there's different there's people giving out and upset that they can't get into the births and stuff. But
yeah.
I didn't get a chance to go into the birth because it was I wasn't going to be allowed in anyway. But it was a little more rushed than we had expected. So
it was
by the time I got to the hospital, the mommy and baby were just coming out of theatre.
Okay, and so how soon after she was born did you finally get to see baby Mia?
Yeah, I got to see baby Mia as they were bringing her up to, they brought her up to the NICU unit in Galway here, which the staff, everybody was so lovely up there, so they were. But they brought the baby upstairs, but then Liz was brought down to her own ward, and I suppose that was the more difficult time really, because I suppose it's always the wife or the partner or that needs support more than the baby on the early days, and that was I suppose more difficult that I wasn't allowed in to see Liz, and but. As I say, we got through it and we're home and everybody's healthy and it's great now.
I mean, how did Liz feel about you not being there? It's probably a lonely enough experience then.
It is. It has to be a very lonely spot for all the ladies that are in having the babies. I suppose when you do have a baby, I suppose the support of your partner or husband or whichever, it's an important thing. But I suppose with the times we're in, Oliver, we all just have to abide by the rules and do the best we can.
And were you out in the car park with a couple of other lads who were also?
Well, I have seen guys waiting in the car parks waiting for the babies and stuff. No, I was just on the last minute, so I just got straight in and I got to see them for a couple of minutes, and then I was up.
Yeah.
I spent the night that night actually when Mia was born. I spent the night up in the NICU unit. It's intensive care really for the baby. So I spent the night up there with her. So I did.
And I mean, there's a lot of people still obviously waiting on little babies to arrive, and I suppose they know now that they're not going to get in, the dads aren't going to get in to witness the birth. So what advice would you have for people going through the same thing that you did?
I definitely would say it's disheartening. It's a tough time for everybody. You'd love to be there to spend time with them and see the birth, and I suppose it's a huge part of life for ourselves and for everybody that is having a baby. It's horrible not being let in, but I suppose when you do get them home, you really it brings the excitement out, and you forget about all the bad times really.
Yeah. And so, I mean, you were discharged. Liz is all. Everyone's at home now, basically.
Yeah, everybody's at home now, and feet are up here, and we're relaxing here, and I suppose feeding the baby, and we're keeping ourselves locked up inside the house, which is that's a real hard time. We've the grannies and granddads haven't got to see Mia yet, so that's a tough time as well. But
yes,
we have to abide by the rules, and hopefully. Once we get the far side of this, we're going to hopefully have a big party.
You'll have a bit of a hoolie then at that stage.
We'll have a hoolie, without a doubt.
And in terms of your own work, Mike, obviously you're one of the country stars. You're going to be gigging every 5 minutes. So
yeah,
you would have had to cancel a huge tranche of gigs.
Oh, it's a desperate time for the music, for the entertainment. It's for the hospitality, really. It's a horrible time. We finished up and we done our last gig on the 8th of March, so we did, and I can't see us work until maybe middle of summer, but that's it's not something that we're looking forward to here, sitting back relaxing, because it's a tough time on everybody. It's a tough time on all musicians, because there's no really other way of getting the music out there. I know that if you're a singer-songwriter, great, you can go on social media and that, but really our end of the music is really about, I suppose it's more about the social end of it, where people are out, it's a live band, it's a live dance, and people use it as a meeting place, so it's a bad time for everybody, for us really.
But I suppose the fact that if the gigs hadn't been cancelled, you wouldn't have all this lovely time with your wife and
new
daughter.
Yeah, well, it's great to be spending time here at home, so it is, but we're really looking forward to as well getting back, because we miss the gigs really. It's anybody will tell you that, Oliver, that's a live gigging band, you miss the buzz of it. It's a great buzz being out there and gigging, and it's a shame that we had to move so many gigs, but I know we had so many of the concerts and stuff that we had to cancel. They've all been rescheduled for over the summertime, and there's lots of stuff hopefully coming in now again that we're going to be buzzing for the summer when everybody's back and enjoying themselves, and we'll all have a huge party over the summer at gigs everywhere.
But in the meantime, you're Mia's little helper, and are you any help to Liz?
Well, I'm doing the feeding anyway at the moment. Not doing bad. I'm doing the feeding and the winding, so I am.
Well, the very congratulations to both of you, to Liz and yourself. And it's great to hear your voice. And
thank
it's great
much,
to hear
Oliver.
Such a lovely story and something that's so nice came out of what was a very difficult situation. The lockdown kind of gave you the benefit of having time with your child.
Me two great women.
And your new album, The Working Man, even though you're not able to tour it at the moment, it is out and people can listen to it.
Yeah, Working Man is available. I was going to say it's available in all good record shops, but I'd say more if you want to check it out. You can check it out online. It's on iTunes, it's on Spotify, and you can buy it online, actually, if you go on to sharpmusic.com. I know it's on sale there, Raymond and all the gang of that, if you want to get a hard copy.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Mike Denver.
Oliver, thank you. Can I just say a quick happy anniversary to my wife?
Ah, yes.
We're 8 years married today, so happy anniversary to her.
God, party all around.
Party all around today. Thanks, Oliver.
Thanks,
God bless.
Million. Keep it country. Theatre designers are finding lovely creative ways to spend your evenings. And Molly O'Cohan is a Swedish-Irish set and costume designer. Swedish-Irish, yes, so both nationalities. Based in London, but she came up to visit her parents a few weeks ago. And she's still here and she's on the line now. Good morning to you, Molly.
Hi, how are you?
Molly O'Cohan or O'Cohan?
Yes, either.
Either, okay. So Swedish-Irish, so one of your parents is Swedish.
My mum is Swedish, yes.
Ah, very good. So you were supposed to come home for a short visit. So tell us what happened.
Well, I came home to work on a theatre festival called Where We Live, which was meant to be on over the Paddy's Day week in Partick Arts Centre. I was meant to be working on two shows in it, and really sadly, on the day that it was meant to open, we had to close. So all the work from all the different artists that were working on the festival was put on pause.
So it's a tough time.
And I got stuck here.
It's a tough time for anyone in the creative industries. Tell me about it. But you've been keeping very busy, and tell us about this amazing project that you've been working on.
Well, in the evenings, I've been trying to keep everyone kind of occupied and busy and stop us from bickering. And so me and my parents have been recreating different portraits from art history and taking photographs on my phone and putting them on Instagram, which I thought would amuse some of my friends because I was a bit bored, and then seems to have brought a lot of people some joy, which is kind of nice.
And they're instantly recognisable, legendary pieces of art, really, aren't they?
Yeah, they're different kind of bits of iconography from across different parts of art history that I sort of realised had two people in them, and they might be fun to photograph my parents in. And
tell us your parents' names.
Liz and Brian.
Liz and Brian. So they've been kind of posing. They've been your putty in your hands.
My models, yeah. And they're my collaborators. So we're doing it together. So we've been digging around the cupboards looking for things and going, what would look like this? And how do we make one of these? And the other night my dad showed up we needed a sword for something, and he went away for a bit, went a bit quiet, and then he came back with a piece of wardrobe and a kitchen knife and a spanner that he'd sort of sellotaped together and went, this is the perfect sword. And it kind of was.
Well, it's art in itself, isn't it, if you're trying to improvise in that way.
Yeah, bored. When you're really bored, there's nothing else to do, art, I suppose.
So American Gothic is the one that really stood out. I thought, like, wow, you know exactly what it is the minute you see it. Can you describe it to people who may not be familiar just by title?
It is a famous American portrait of two people standing side by side outside a sort of American, it could be a church or a house, sort of clapboard. And it is, I think it's actually meant to be a daughter and father, but I think everyone presumes that they're a married couple. And it is a famous, American painting of...
There's an Amish look about it, but your parents are there and they're recreating with their stoic faces.
Yes, they're very good at doing stoic faces. They've gotten good at it. My dad's wearing my mum's glasses in that photo, which I think is quite funny.
Okay. And you can't really tell if they're doing it because it's like, oh, would Molly ever stop and make us do this?
Very possibly. I think they might be getting sick of me at times. But for the most part, I think it's keeping spirits, the mood up and spirits light, and they're enjoying it as well.
And what else have you done?
We did my favourite painting, the Klimt's The Kiss, which is a sort of yellow painting that's quite famous. And we did a meeting on the Turret Stairs, which is in the National Gallery, and I think is Ireland's favourite painting.
Exactly, yes, very popular.
I don't know how they decided that, but anyways, I think it is.
That must have been fun recreating. Must have been fun recreating that one, because it's a very romantic pose, isn't it?
It's beautiful, yeah, and we found some raincoats, which were just the right colour of blue.
Right.
So there's my mum's whole sort of dress and skirt is made up of a few different pieces of rain grain clothing and lots of scarves from the scarf collection.
You actually can't tell. It looks quite elaborate. And I thought for a minute, well, you know, costume and all that. Sure, she knows what she's doing and she must have a big store load.
No, there's nothing complicated about it. I was laughing at people commenting online saying, God, where'd you get all these costumes from? And I was saying, it's like bits of underwear and raincoats and bits from the kitchen and, you know, blankets and rugs. And there's nothing particularly complicated about any of it. It's just trying to find, I suppose, the challenge of inventive ways to use things to pose as a good distraction.
Are there great paintings that you want to recreate that are might be more challenging?
Top of the list is the Arnolfini portrait, but it's difficult. People might know it because it was in the credits of Desperate Housewives. I think that's what's most famous for it in sort of pop culture, but it's a really famous painting.
It's got the mirror in the background.
A man and wife. And it is just a lot of elements involved in it, and a lot of sort of a really rich emerald green colour, of which no matter how much we hunt the house, we can't seem to find anything which is that colour. We're waiting for an ambitious evening when we've got lots of time to try and attempt it.
Maybe someone can post you a Donegal jersey or something.
That would be great. Yeah, a couple of even Ireland jerseys would do anything like that. Anything green or some old curtains or whatever's going. I don't know what else we've been thinking of doing. Maybe a Renoir. There's a nice Renoir called Dance in the Country. But it's been very cold, so I'm waiting for a day when I feel like I can put my parents in the garden and not feel bad about it.
It sounds both sophisticated and a bit of crack.
It's just definitely primarily crack. Started off as being very silly, and then I got surprised. Well, now it's funny because I put them up for maybe 12 or 13 days now. So now, last night we were a bit sluggish and tired, and I sort of went, we have to do one if we don't want to anymore, which is probably good because I'm not achieving very much else with my days. So
and how long? How long is it taking you to actually put them together?
Like an hour or two in the evenings. Okay. It's instead of watching a movie. My telly watching is way down, which is a bit sad. I'm not getting through all these amazing series that everyone else is watching because I'm...
But you're busy, so it's obviously... It's good for your mind, though, I would imagine, because you're busy and you're doing what you're
doing. Yeah, it's good. I mean, it's really sad for kind of the creative industries and for freelancers. It's been really difficult to have all of your kind of very carefully planned work cancelled overnight, as I'm sure lots of people know. Also the kind of, you know, there's so many people that are having a really difficult time across the country right now, and I'm very lucky and privileged in that I'm primarily just bored. So for now, I'm trying to...
Having fun, but by staying in and doing what we're doing, we're helping people, helping more people.
Yeah, that'll help to flatten the curve.
In terms of trying to get back to work and all, are you just trying not to think about the maybes, ifs, guessing when it might happen and all of that?
Yeah, I think it's hard to know. I'm currently working in London for a year, but of course that's on pause as well. So we won't know really what will happen. And we don't really know when the freelance industry will kick back into action because obviously we don't know how long this will go on for. And then we don't know what the economic effect of that will be on different industries. It's kind of hard to predict. But I think it is important to think about how much people are consuming culture. Yeah. You know, we don't necessarily always value culture workers and how fragile their economies are and their position in society. But then in these times of crisis, when they are the people that instantly get really terrified because they don't have any kind of fallback or cushioning or safety net, we're watching movies every night and listening to podcasts and reading books and taking so much joy and solace from the output of the creative industries. So I think it's important to keep sort of to value all the cultural workers that we have and think about how we can support them in the future.
So how do we have a look at all your amazing works on Frida? On Salvador Dali's recreations, how do we see them with our very eyes?
Currently they are on my Instagram account and they are also on Twitter. I guess I'll keep posting them there as long as this keeps going on, I suppose.
Keep on trucking,
unless we get really bored or sick of each other. We'll see.
And we'll put the link and we put the details on our website as well, so you can go and
good.
Marvel.
And I'm taking requests. So if anyone has any good ideas of pictures or paintings with two people in them, they can
Thanks to your parents, Liz and Brian, who've done all of the kind of standing there for
all of the standing. They enjoy it. I think I'm a good distraction as well.
Listen, Molly, thank you very much.
Take care. Have a lovely day.
Same to you. And they're really good fun, and they're quite sophisticated and like just very nice things to look at in these times. I'm sure that's why we're scrolling mindlessly through everything. But this is a lovely, sophisticated recreations of art. And welcome back. It's Oliver Callan in for Ryan this fine morning. Now, while we're living through this global crisis, our personal difficulties can't go on hold and our ability to cope may be tested now more than ever. Our guest this morning knows all about facing personal challenges, having overcome 15 years of heroin addiction. Brian Penny got a second chance at life. He's here to tell the tale. Good morning to you, Brian.
Good morning, Oliver. How are you?
So this is a hopeful tale.
It is, the ending's a good ending.
So let's start at the start, Brian. Where are you from? Why did you call home?
Home for me, I lived most of my life since I was 6 years of age in Blanterstown in West Dublin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ladieswell.
Ladieswell. Drumheath is specifically the area where I grew up in, so it would have been like a disadvantaged area, I suppose you could call it, back in Ireland. Yeah, yeah.
So it would be fair to say there was a bit of crime.
A lot of crime, to be quite honest. A lot of crime, a lot of drugs, a lot of violence back then as well. Yeah, it wasn't a tough place to grow.
What was your growing up like in that area then? You could not be unaffected by all that.
No, and for myself personally, even though I was around all of that stuff as well, like growing up I was big into football and I was pretty good in school early on as well.
Yeah.
But for me, I had a pretty traumatic childhood. I had a lot of trauma in the very early years as a baby. I had a big operation with complications from that as well. And that really set the tone for my life, I firmly believe. It set the tone, it set the primary for a life of anxiety. So I was always a very anxious child.
Okay.
And I suppose growing up, even though I had a relatively good, I came from a really loving family, a great family. There were difficulties in the family as well, but very loving family. But I was always very anxious and a very restless child. And I suppose growing up in Ladieswell, I was around a lot of drugs. It was probably just a matter of time before I tried drugs at one stage. And once I tried that, it was really game over for me. It was just like the difference between me being very anxious, very restless, very agitated. As soon as I tried drugs, that just took that away. And it was a game changer for me at the time, you know.
What age are you when you start going off course, and how quickly did it escalate?
Right, so I started. I was crazy about football. I mean, my whole life was about football. So I had a little bit of a knee injury when I was 14, and all my friends smoked, but I would never smoke a cigarette. But I remember I was injured for a couple of months, and one of them actually said that they were high, a little head buzz to get off a cigarette. And I remember being sort of saying, oh, I like the idea of that little high. And I took my first puff of a cigarette at 14. And that was sort of the start for me. I got that little head buzz. I was smoking hash within a couple of weeks, I think.
Right.
And within a couple of months, I was doing other drugs, acid and stuff like that. And it just escalated very, very quickly, I have to say. And by the time I was 16, 17, I was on opiates and I was messing around with heroin.
So by 17, you were hooked on heroin.
Yeah, I said this in the book as well. So I was mentally addicted. I done heroin when I was 17. I actually done methadone first, believe it or not, which is actually a bit strange. I didn't realise it was an opiate substitute at the time. Yeah. And I done that when I was 16. But when I was 17, I tried heroin for the first time. And that was just like a complete game changer for me. I remember thinking, describing it as nirvana on earth when I done it. And I'm obviously not promoting it. It will bring you to hell.
Yeah.
Well, it was just like, compared to me previously anxious self, it just made everything still and made everything okay. And although I was mentally addicted from that very moment, it was like heroin spoke to me that night. I'll never forget that night.
Really?
Well, it was still a few years before I was actually physically addicted, because I write a lot about it in the book. I was actually really self-delusional. So I was never going to be a real addict. I was like too good to be a real addict. And I lived that facade for many years. But by the time I was 20, I was a full-blown addict, and then I had to go on to a methadone program soon after that as well.
But in the meantime, I mean, you were still in school when you started, and you actually got your leaving cert.
Yeah, I got quite a decent leaving cert as well. Obviously, it would have been a lot better if I wasn't messing around with drugs. Yeah. But I got a decent leaving cert, and I went to college even for a couple of months. I went to art college for a couple of months.
Right.
Well, the funny thing about myself was, and this is quite common. A lot of people start to think of heroin addicts, and they think of the stereotypical heroin addict on the streets and all this kind of stuff. But
homeless, jobless,
mugging people, and all of these kinds of things. But I was a very, very functional addict. Well, like I was a heroin addict. I was a registered heroin addict on a methadone program for all of my 30s, and I was highly, highly functional for much of that time. It's debatable how functional I was. I talked to people who were around me at the time and they'll sort of debate that in a joking way, but I was pretty functional and I held on to a job.
Yeah, because you got a job in those when you were starting out in college. You got a job and held on to it, so that's fairly functional. What did you do?
Yeah, it was a sort of graphic reproduction in the printing industry, and I held on to that job all the time, it's crazy when you look back now. It was really funny because my decline was so slow. Like even there's pictures of what I've did before after pictures, and when you look at what I was like before and what I'm like now, the difference is like extraordinary. It's like a completely different people. But my family and people in the workplace as well, because the decline was so slow, it was very, very, very difficult to see. Okay. It was only when I got clean that the ramifications of how bad I was really came to the fore, you know?
How aware are you? You're addicted to heroin. You're going through your 20s. You're holding down a job. A lot of people probably don't even know you're on something. How do you feel about yourself? Are you aware of what you're doing to yourself at that stage?
No, for me, and this is the crux of it right here, Oliver, really. I was completely unaware. I was so self-delusional. Self-deception was, like I was a black belt in self-deception. I referenced that in the book many times. And I could really, I had this internal narrative that I believed. Like my internal narrative was, I struggle with anxiety, I cannot cope, and I need heroin to survive. And that was my sense of self, my sense of identity. And I would do anything to keep that story going.
Yeah.
So there was no awareness there that I could do anything else. So there was no... I think awareness is the opposite of addiction, in essence. When I went to a treatment centre, there was a priest there that was just amazing. And he called it an awareness centre. Because once you become aware, that's where the change happens. So I was so unaware of deceiving myself. It's scary when I look at the self-delusional... web of lies that I brought myself into.
It's not just yourself you're harming. Tell us what happened in 2006 to the family.
They say like it's a great line. I think it's from AA. It's, addiction as a family isn't a spectator sport. Eventually, the whole family gets to play.
Yeah,
I love that line. And is that the fire incident you're referencing to, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So it was, one evening, and I start one of the chapters off in the book like this. I was, nothing wakes me up from sleep, never did, and I'm a very heavy sleeper. But one night I was just asleep in my room when I was living with my parents, and I woke up, and there was this, like, crackling noise outside, and I thought it was a bit of a funny noise. And I just got this horrible feeling in the pit of my stomach, and I was just like, oh, something's wrong. And I just looked out the window, and the cars were on fire in the garden. So basically, I won't go into the details of what happened, but it was something to do with my behaviour, basically. And the cars were set on fire, and the front of the house went on fire, and the whole house nearly burnt down as well. So it was a terrible incident for my family. My sister, my mum was in the house, my brothers were in the house. So I moved out soon after that, but I really, like, the damage and the pain that I brought to my family over the years, and I didn't realise, I never felt it. It was only actually writing the memoir that I actually felt the pain that I caused in family. There was still a bit of self-deception going on there as well. I was refusing to feel that pain. But when I wrote the memoir, I really felt it, let me tell you.
I mean, it's called Bonus Time, so there's obviously life after the addiction. In the middle, I mean, does that incident, that the fire outside the house, does that spark the beginning of the end of the... Of your troubles, or what happens? How do you get get to that wake up call?
Yeah, not even close. It was a good few years after that. Like I brought a lot of pain to my family. It was like I talk about in terms of scarring. There's this relentless scarring where they were just watching me destroy myself with drugs.
Right.
Like I was literally just killing myself, killing my body, killing my mind, emotionally, physically. There was no spiritual life there. I didn't even know what that was. And there was many more years of just bringing myself. I was nearly dead. Physically, I was nearly dead. There was nothing left. I was on my way out. And funny enough, I was still, like, surviving in work, still keeping my job, but I was losing my job. How I funded myself throughout my addiction, like, there was some illegal activities as well there.
Yeah.
But all of that fell apart. I couldn't fund my addiction. My whole sense of self was built around that. I fund my addiction, I get drugs, and I keep that alive.
How did you fund it?
Well, I sold drugs as well throughout my addiction. So I was always to fund that. I did not use that as an excuse. It was always to fund my habit, but I sold drugs. I done whatever I could. But my job was my number one thing to be able to, once I had my job and to pay the bills, to pay me a big drug debt, like around 500-600 quid a week, and heroin, just to keep your heroin habit.
I mean, your employer must have been very forgiving of a lot of your behaviour. What was a normal day like at work?
A normal day would have been, a normal day started for me, so I describe it in the book, and I say, like, I would have gone to bed at about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I wouldn't have slept. That's where anxiety lived horrifically in my mind. And I might have gotten 2 or 3 hours. I'd have waken up in the morning, and I would have been just like, how am I going to get through this day? And I was always just fighting against anxiety. So when I went to work, I tried not to use drugs. So I'd be really just fighting against anxiety, trying to get through the day, feeling so restless, so agitated, because the addiction was making the anxiety worse. It was like a snake trying to eat its own tail. Like, I was using drugs to get away from anxiety, but it was actually making it worse. And just walking was just getting harder and harder and harder and harder. And then I got friends in the job as well, so it was very difficult. Like, we're real family orientated in the job as well, so it was very difficult for them on a personal level to see me destroying myself. And I got to the stage where I just wasn't operating anymore. It was so difficult to be around, and they just had to get rid of me. And once I had no job, I had no way of funding the addiction anymore.
So you went for treatment, but they told you, don't go cold turkey.
Don't go cold turkey. Yeah. What did they say? If you go cold turkey, you'll have a seizure. And special me at the time, so I won't have a seizure. So I says, I tried to get into a detox centre to do a detox, but because of benzodiazepine in my system, I was at high risk for seizures. That was the problem. So they couldn't let me in until they were out of my system. So I said, I'll do cold turkey at home. I won't have a seizure. And lo and behold, I had a seizure. Right. But that turned out, that was actually the most, I describe it as the most painful night of my life. But it was also
this is cold turkey night.
Gone cold turkey, yeah. What actually happened was when I was 2 days into my cold turkey detox at home, and I had a seizure, I had a full-blown convulsive seizure. And what actually happened was I drove my teeth into my tongue, and I sort of split down the centre of my tongue, yeah, so with blood everywhere. My family thought I was dead. My brother thought I was dead. He rang my family, and everyone started coming around thinking this was the end. I think they were waiting for it for many years. But that was probably the best thing that ever happened to me, Oliver, because it broke me so badly. I stopped the fight. I was always fighting with my own mind, fighting with reality. The reality was I was killing myself, but I was fighting against that, trying to keep the addiction alive. But once I stopped fighting and I surrendered to reality, my life just completely changed.
So October 2013, we're talking now. You wake up and you have your first day clean.
Yeah. So that would have been, the seizure would have happened in around August. So I had another couple of seizures after that, another couple of hospital visits. Then I went to a detox facility, and another 5 weeks there getting off heroin, coming off heroin now, or opiates, methadone there as well. Wow. But the October 8th was my first day clean, and I'll never forget it. It was the most incredible day of my life. It was like the fire extinguisher, the seizure incident where I split my tongue. And that sort of was a crack in the ego that allowed me to see the world a little bit differently. But when all the drugs were out of my system and that first day clean, it was just like this, all I can describe is like this light came into my life. And I always had such a busy mind. I was tormented by my mind and just consumed by anxiety. But it was like that morning, that in that detox facility, I was on a farm. And I walked out onto the farm, and I was just, I'll never forget, it was like it was a real dew-soaked October morning. And it was like the dewdrops looked like diamonds shining, and the sun was coming up, and it was just life. It was just so alive. The whole world just came alive. And what I've since realised was that my mind went quiet. I think that the pain of whatever happened to me, it just forced my mind into shutting down. So my mind went very quiet. The self-talk, that thinking went very quiet. And with that, anxiety just left me. And I just felt absolutely amazing, energised, so much energy. And it was just like this joy came into my life. And I genuinely haven't looked back then. I've really just, I jumped onto that bandwagon and just sailed with it, you know.
And what have you been doing with your life since then?
So since then, I often say I switched addictions because I just became obsessed with learning and the Eastern philosophy. So
a bit healthier.
A lot healthier. So it's not addiction. We call it drive now, you know. So a lot of exercise. I exercise as well. You have to keep balance with that as well. But it was big. I wanted to learn about human suffering and about my experience, how I could help others. So I got a degree in psychology in Maynooth University, and now I'm doing a PhD in Trinity College, and we're exploring the impact of mindfulness for people in early recovery from addiction. So that's in the Rutland Centre. And just marvellous opportunities of community life, really. So I got a lecturing position in UCD teaching the neuroscience of mindfulness, and I'm teaching the neuroscience of addiction in Trinity College as well. So it was just all from this curiosity for learning, and it's probably the biggest thing. Even though academia is a massive part of my life, the thing that really lights me up and really inspires me is I've learned about so many tools and tactics about coping with the uncertainty of life, the hassles of life.
It sounds like you could be of assistance to us right now. I mean, how are your own anxiety levels at the minute?
My anxiety, I have such an amazing relationship with anxiety, which is a strange thing to say. So I obviously still get anxious. Like, even before this call, I'd never done it before. It's the unknown. That's where anxiety lives, and I thought about the unknown. Yeah. But my relationship with anxiety is just, I was sitting here in my room about to go on the call. I was just watching the anxiety, and I said, yeah, you'll come, then you'll go, and it'll be fine. Yeah. So, like, we get anxious. That's okay, especially now in these uncertain times. We're going to get anxious. It's normal to be anxious. But it's about your relationship with anxiety, and bringing yourself into the present moment is very important as well. Like, focusing on what you can control. Like, we often get very anxious about the things we can't control, like the coronavirus, other people's behaviour. But focus on what you can control, like your behaviour, your attitude, your reaction to events, and you can stem the tide of anxiety again, you know?
If you're worried about something that you can't control, then you just have to change your attitude to it.
Or focus on what you can control, you know.
How is your relationship with your family since then? Because obviously they went through hell.
They went through hell. My relationship with family is amazing today. I said it earlier, addiction isn't a spectator sport. Eventually the whole family get to play. But thankfully, so is recovery. And, like, I'm writing an article at the moment about the experience I had by writing my memoir. And one of the biggest things that happened to me was the relationship with my mum and my sister particularly had just gone up 10 levels. It's just, when I was writing the memoir, I intellectually knew the damage that I caused my family, but I never actually felt it. But by writing the memoir and talking to them about it, I felt it. And I felt their pain. And by I suppose, validating their feelings and me really feeling it as well, and it, like, that hit me hard. But our relationships have just gone to another level. It was very therapeutic. And I think that the whole family are just very, very close now. And it's an amazing bond we have together, which is an amazing thing to say after everything I put them through.
Like, well, it's a great thing to say as well.
A great thing to say. I'm very thankful for them as well, for sticking with me throughout the whole ordeal, you know.
So bonus time, that's the memoir that you're talking about that you've worked on.
Yeah.
There's a lovely question at the back of it. How would you live differently if life gave you a second chance?
Yeah.
And I mean, I think everyone is slowing down now. They're in lockdown. They have to park the anxiety or deal with as best they can. And it is kind of an intriguing question. And you answer it, and the answer is very positive.
Yeah. And it's my answer to that is, how would I live? How would I live if I had a second chance at life? The way I would live is, I don't let things outside of my control me. I don't worry about what others are thinking. I don't compare myself to others. And you also have to dream big and take chances, but live freely. I think that's the key thing. And right now, I think, like, what would you do? I think you could reframe that question now.
Yeah.
What would you do if you had a second chance now after, a lot of people are having a reality check right now, and maybe it's a time to rebuild and reevaluate our lives.
Yeah.
So you could use, like, after post-COVID-19, that's your second chance. How are you going to live that? Have you focused on things that are probably more important to you now than the things that you thought were important? Like,
brilliant.
I think we're really finding out what's important now and what really matters, you know?
I mean, there's a theory out there that the Chinese word for crisis has two meanings. One is danger, the other is opportunity. So use the opportunity to do what you're saying. Now, you've inspired plenty of people this morning, Brian. A text coming in says, every second level student, along with fifth and sixth class students, should be compelled to listen to that interview with that wonderful and wise young man and write an essay on what is to be learned from that interview as homework tonight. Best education for everyone. Best wishes to that hero, says our texter.
Well, great,
they can do more than that. They can read the memoir Bonus Time, published by Gill Books. It's available online from Eason and Dubray Books. But there are delivery restrictions at the moment, isn't there? Because of the obvious.
Because of the obvious. But you get it on e-book as well now, on Kindle. iBooks as well at the moment. The opportunity is there for that as well.
You can keep up with brianpenny.com. And you're on Instagram as well, brianpenny78, Penny IE. Listen, it's been great to chat to you.
It's been amazing. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, fantastic. And we wish you all the best.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Thanks a million, Brian Sloan.
See you now.
Welcome back. It's Oliver Callan in for Ryan Tubridy. Now, it's been a stressful time for Irish Olympic hopefuls as they waited to hear if this week's Olympic Games would go ahead. 2 days ago, it was announced the Games will now happen a year later than planned, July 2021. One such Irish athlete who was anxiously awaiting for news was swimmer Nicholas Quinn from County Mayo. However, his grueling Olympics training wasn't the only challenge he has had during the last year or so. He joins us on the line now. Good morning, Nicholas.
Good morning, Oliver. Thanks for having me on. How are things?
Not so bad at all. So how did you feel when you heard that the Olympics were being put off, postponed?
I think there was, to be honest, the first feeling was just relief, because obviously we've been drip-fed information for a couple of days before then, and you're kind of thinking, this can't go ahead with everything that's going on in the world. And I think the problem was your athletes are trying to put themselves out to try and train and carry on their routines as well as they can in exceptional circumstances, and it's just not possible. So I think my initial reaction was relief that now I don't have to try and keep pushing myself and putting myself and potentially others in danger. Yeah. I can just sit back and now focus on trying to play my part and staying home and getting through this, and then can get back to training if that's what I decide.
And you would have been actually in the middle of qualifying right now.
Yeah, so our chance to qualify for the swimming was this weekend. The Irish Olympic trials were being held in the Aquatic Centre out in Blanchardstown. So they were due to be starting yesterday and running right through to the weekend. So the swimmers would have all been trying to qualify this weekend. So it's a big change from who we were expected to be.
Yeah. But in terms of the training now, I mean, do you completely stop? Can you actually even get into a swimming pool?
Lockdown, yeah, all the facilities are closed, so there's no pools. I've not been in the water for 10 days at this stage, which for me seems like an eternity. So it's a big change, but the Olympics now, as we found out, are July next year. So that gives us over a year. So it allows athletes to now not really, that's not the main goal. It is obviously still the main goal, but it's not the immediate goal. The short-term goal is now to get through however long this is and then pick back up training and start back. So I'm having to find other ways to keep fit, but it's now more to keep my sanity than anything else, than trying to keep myself at top physical shape. It's just that if I was stuck in the house all day, I would go mad. So getting out for a run or going for a little bit of a cycle, I've managed to set up a spin bike in my living room, so I'm kind of getting on that and just doing what I can more to keep sane and give a bit of structure to my days is now the amount of exercise I'm doing.
So, I mean, you're right at peak fitness right now, aren't you? You're 26.
Yeah, 26, yeah. This is kind of prime time of my career, I guess. And I was really looking forward to competing. I feel like I was in probably the best place of my career going into this qualification meet in Dublin. And I was really looking forward to what I could do. But that all now changes. But it does. I guess from my point of view, all the work that I've done leading up to this doesn't go to waste. It's still a privilege to be able to try and get yourself into the best possible position to try and compete and see what you are capable of. And the ability and the opportunity to do that is just, I'm very fortunate to be able to do that. So I don't consider it wasted, but it's disappointing that I don't get to see what the fruits of that work is, I guess.
And does it make a huge difference? I mean, do you look at an extra year as more time to prepare, or are you worried about being a little bit older?
I guess I'm not worried about being a little bit older. For me, I always viewed this year as 2020 was probably kind of my time with swimming. I've been swimming my whole life, and I was fortunate enough to qualify and compete in Rio. Yeah. And I kind of had set myself 2020 was like, this is a good kind of marker to see where I'm at and potentially call it a day after that. So that brings up a whole other load of questions, and that I was probably looking at finishing off my college and then looking at getting a job and moving into the next chapter of my life, I guess you could say. And now I have to reevaluate and see is it there in terms of the body, in terms of can I stay injury and can I stay healthy for another year? And then more importantly, is am I mentally capable of going through it for another year? Because it's easy to go through the motions and turn up and train and do all the necessary things for an elite. From my point of view, that's the easy part. The hard part is being mentally in it and really committed. And because it's all the small details. If you're not 100% in at elite level in sport, it's not good enough.
And you've had huge highs and lows in your life already. I mean, obviously Rio being the high point 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And your father was with you in Rio. But life for your family changed dramatically after that.
Yeah, it did. So, yeah, Rio was an amazing experience and definitely fulfilled a lifelong ambition. But then, yeah, as you said, since then, it's been probably a bit of a more turbulent path than I probably would have envisaged in Rio. So Dad died. He was big into hill walking and he had a hill walking accident in 2018 in May, and he fell and he died, which threw everything into the air and made me kind of question what I was doing and where I wanted to go with my sport and with my life in general. And it changed my perception on everything. So it was a big change and a struggle kind of for 2 or 3 years, and still dealing with that kind of aspect of grief. But
tell us about your father, John Quinn. He was a huge influence on you.
He was a massive influence. I think in swimming, it's such a grueling sport in terms of the hours and commitment that you need, that Mum and Dad were sacrificing everything to bring me to competitions, to let me do this, to support me in any way they could. And Dad was heavily involved in the club in Castlebar from when I was small. Like, he used to bring me swimming. I'm the youngest in my family, and he used to bring me swimming on a Sunday morning just to give Mam a bit of space in the house on her own, so she wouldn't be going mad. So he was a huge influence on me, and he taught me in the swimming club as I was kind of going up through the different classes and different levels, and then was influential in my career the whole way out. And swimming is not just swimming, in every aspect of my life. Like, he was
an adventurer, wasn't he?
He was. He was big into diving and hill walking, and he was part of the Subaco Club, the Gorney Wales Subaco Club in Mayo, and then he started a hill walking club. He kind of moved to Strasbourg in France the last few years of his life, and he set up a hill walking club, and he'd be out walking every weekend. So he was outdoors, and the sea are a huge part of all of our lives, and I think that comes from Dad's kind of love of nature and being outside and being active, I guess.
So, I mean, for years and years, you would have, the family obviously would have been worried that something terrible might happen in the ocean where he was doing the scuba diving. But in the end, it was hiking.
Yeah, I think Mam always used to say that when she was diving, when Dad was diving, when they were diving, we'd all go out to the sea and we'd spend the day out on the piers or wherever we were diving from in Mayo. And we'd spend days fishing and just spending the day at the beach while they'd be out diving on the boats. And I guess that was always the worry. You think of diving as relatively dangerous in terms of the equipment failure and all the possible things. I think that's definitely more of a worry. I think when Dad stopped diving and kind of started focusing more on hill walking, it was definitely seen as a safer pastime. Yeah. But look, accidents happen, and it was literally, we think it was just a trip. Just he lost his footing and slipped, and they were at the edge of a kind of a cliff, and that's how life happens, and that's the thing, life changes. And
it's only been 2 years ago.
May 2018.
Right.
May 2018.
And where were you at the time?
I was in Edinburgh. I'm based in Edinburgh. I'm training in Edinburgh. And at the time, my brother and my sister were both living in Scotland as well. And Mam had just decided to come over to Edinburgh for the weekend just to visit us. It was just a coincidence. And it was actually one of the reasons why Dad was out walking on that Saturday. Normally, they'd walk on the Sundays. But he was out walking on Saturday because Mam was in Edinburgh. And they'd just started their walk, and they were at the top of a viewing point, and they were getting ready to leave and kind of start the rest of the walk. And as he turned, he just lost his footing or got caught on something and kind of fell backwards with his backpack.
Yeah. It was a terrible tragedy. So, and where did it happen?
In Strasbourg. So he's in Strasbourg, and it happened in the Vosges Mountains. So it's right on the border between France and Germany.
And you went there yourself. Tell us about that day.
Yeah, so that was Saturday. That was literally Saturday morning. And the next morning, me, my brother Darren, my sister Fionnuala, and Mam flew straight to Basel and drove to Colmar and identified Dad's body, and then we met some of the walkers who were with Dad on the walk to kind of find out more information, because I guess it was a bit, the information was a bit sketchy at the time because we didn't really know. And so we wanted to meet the walkers and, I guess, from our point of view, try and piece together what actually happened and how he fell and what occurred. And then we spent a week in France trying to figure out the logistics of getting Dad's body home and funeral in Mayo, and then kind of spent the summer in Casabarra trying to figure out what the next stages were for me. I was still in college at that stage, so I came back to Edinburgh in that September, and I decided to kind of go back swimming.
Yeah.
But to be honest with you, my head wasn't really in it for the first couple of months until I just, with everything, I just wasn't. I was going through the motions, and I think that's where I learned that you can go and turn up to training and do what you've been asked, but it's completely different to being in it. So those few months I kind of was, I guess, plodding along through the training, but not really purposeful training.
Yeah. I mean, you're still a young, you were only 24 at the time, you're a young man now. It was a lot to have to deal with. So obviously you didn't have a great year swimming then, that year. But did it help? Did swimming then become a kind of a mechanism to deal with grief for you?
Yeah, I think it did. I think, and it, like, swimming is what I know. Swimming is what I've done all my life, and it's kind of guided me and directed all the decisions I've made in my life up to this point. And it's not really surprising that it was a massive help in me going through that grieving process and giving me time to think. I'm probably the type of person who moves on to the next thing very quickly and keeps, okay, what's the next goal? And I think I did that a little bit with Dad, and I think I was like, when I went back to Edinburgh, came back to Edinburgh in September after Dad died, I was like, okay, back into swimming now, let's get focused. But I almost needed that 3 months of where I was swimming, and look, when you're in the water, you're staring at a black line and you're in your own thoughts a lot. And I think that gave me a bit of time and space and a bit of perspective. I think initially I was like, okay, let's do this. Let's aim for Tokyo and let's kind of do it to make Dad proud, to do it for him.
Yeah.
But I'd always realised, I guess, in my own career, when I sat back and looked back at it, I'd never swam for anyone else. I swam for, one, I loved the sport, and two, I liked, the main reason I swim is because I want to see what I can do, what can I achieve, how good can I be, or what are the limits.
Yeah.
And Dad was just supportive in that. And I think once I realised that, it's too emotional when I was trying to do it for him, as instead of taking it back and be like, look, I hope he was proud of me.
I'm sure he was.
I can focus on myself and why I want to do this. And it helped me just change, I guess, the mental balance of the reasons and the why of what I was doing.
It kind of gives it a certain meaning in a way. Because
yeah, it does.
I'm just interested in the actual, just swimming, as we know, there's only, the pool can't get any longer. So it's kind of relentless and it's repetitive. Is your head totally clear when you're doing the training, when you're in the water, or are you actually processing your thoughts?
So ideally, you'd want to be pretty clear and pretty focused on what the task is and what the set is and what the specific technical areas you're working on. And that's what you need to be doing. But like I said, like, you are in your own thoughts a lot. And a lot of the time when you're doing easier sets, aerobic sets, you can get in your own thoughts. And I think for me at that time in September, that those couple of months, it was quite difficult, but it was also probably a really important part for me to have that space where I probably wasn't as focused on the technical and the trying to get better at swimming. It was just giving me time to let my thoughts do what they were wanting to do and go through all the different stages and come to the conclusions of what I want to do and why I want to do this, why I want to swim, and what it means to me, and how my outlook, I guess, changed after Dad dying. It puts swimming in perspective for me as well. Like,
did it help?
Swimming is amazing, and I love it, and it's a huge part of my life. But at the end of the day, it is a sport, and life is going to go on regardless.
Did it help the family as well to kind of rally around behind you and have this Tokyo goal, particularly your mum? I mean, how's she been?
Yeah, I think it did. I think we're all a little bit in flux. Or Fionnuala, Dan and Mam were all a bit in flux and still are a bit in flux in terms of where they were based and what they were doing.
Yeah.
And I was probably the most set in terms of, okay, I know where I'm going to be for the next 18 months to 2 years, and I know what I'm going to be doing, and like, every bit of structure and they were all planning to be in Dublin for trials this year, and they were at like World Championship trials last March in Dublin, and it gave a bit of structure in terms of, yeah, definitely, I think it probably did. Well, there's something to kind of rally behind.
There's plenty of support coming in on the text from you, Nicholas. 51551. Keep the faith, Nicholas, is one simple one. What a brave, articulate young man. Wishing him well, and may he get back to swimming soon, says Nina in Leitrim. I know about swimming up in Leitrim. I think they have 4 miles of a coastline there. But listen, this time next year, then you'll be in the qualifying for Tokyo 2020, although it's happening in July 2021.
Yeah, so I guess that's probably looking what I'm looking towards, and over the next couple of weeks with what Everton are faced at the minute, I'll make a decision on where the next stage of my career is, and if I think I have another year in me. But I think physically I do, but it's just whether I can get myself in the right headspace to have another crack at it, I guess.
Very good. Mags Call tweets, great interview, lovely and sad remembering your dad, John Quinn, thinking of you all, and best of luck with your quest for the Olympics. So that's in from Mags. Look, you've given us all something to root for next year, Nicholas. And you're from Mayo. There are spirited people.
Yeah, for sure.
They don't like losing.
Sure.
And they love when it's a bit of success. And we wish you well in all
Thanks
that you do.
Much.
And you and your family.
Thank you, Oliver.
Take it easy.
You too. Thanks very much.
Good luck to you. Good morning.